Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we always start with some debt-related news and facts for the week. And this is from the Yahoo Sports blog by Trey Kirby, titled, Ed Curry Makes a Lot, Spends a Lot, and Owes a Lot of Money. Ed Curry made a shade over $10 million this year as a member of the New York Knicks. Normally, I'd have said playing for the New York Knicks, but that's a bit of an overstatement as Curry saw time in only 7 games this season. Somehow, that's an improvement as the big guy appeared in just 3 contests the previous year. Baby steps, you guys. Despite that enormous salary and the fact that Curry has made more than $57 million in his 9-year career, the former number 4 draft pick is seriously in debt. As the Associated Press reports, Curry defaulted on a $575,000 loan with an 85% interest rate, which can only happen in Nevada, and has been ordered to pay back $1.2 million to All Star Capital Inc., the world's most ironic loan service. However, Curry argues that he shouldn't have to pay off that debt because he's spending too much money in other places. According to reports filed in the suit, Curry's outgoing payments include $30,000 a month for household expenses, $17,000 a month to various relatives, including his parents, sister, and father-in-law, more than $1,000 a month for cable and satellite television, $207,000 a month in garnished wages that haven't been elaborated upon, but adds up to almost $2.5 million that Eddie Curry never sees over the course of a year, and $350,000 to Juwan Howard, with no elaboration. Curry owns 12 cars, 3 of which, a Rolls-Royce convertible and 2 Land Rovers, may be taken by All Star Capital, though Curry's lawyer says that they have reached a mutually satisfactory resolution of the matter. Maybe Curry gets one of the Land Rovers and can drive the Rolls to important events. Seems fair, right? Furthermore, Curry is still involved in that creepy sexual harassment lawsuit from January of last year. Oh, and he's fighting with lawyers who he says mismanaged his money, leading to the foreclosure of his $3.7 million home near Chicago. Not to mention Curry's son's mother was murdered in January of 2009. Saying it's been a rough 16 months for the former Chicago standout is selling things a little short. On the bright side, Curry holds a player option of $11.2 million on his contract for next season. Pretty safe bet that he takes the Knicks up on that, even if he never sees a cent of it. Interestingly enough, a lot of this is taking place in Nevada, where the legislature had repealed the usury laws in the 80s, thus the 85% interest rate for Curry. It's been reported by attorneys there that the payday loan rate for interest is sometimes over 1,000%. But just so you don't feel bad for Curry or the fact that there are people out there that are making that kind of money, it has been reported that 40% of NBA players file for bankruptcy within 2 years of retirement, and it's about the same for NFL retirees. Most of them don't seem to have financial planners, but rather entourages of family members and sycophants that tend to bleed them dry. Also from a colleague in Nevada, he said that he recently saw a Nevada personal injury loan that was seeking to recover over $20,000 on a $2,500 loan that was less than 4 years old. It had a 400% interest rate associated with it and was gaining interest at about $1,000 per month. So the moral of the story is be careful of what you borrow. It may come back to haunt you. Next up from the dailycaller.com by John Ward. There's a fiery debate in Washington over whether Congress is about to slip a massive taxpayer-funded bailout for failing union pension plans to the tune of $165 billion in an already bloated emergency spending bill. What is certain is that no such move is imminent. Legislation sponsored in the Senate by Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania and Representative Earl Pomeroy of North Dakota was not attached to the bill moving through the House and Senate for votes last week. But a close examination of the Case Pomeroy bill by the Daily Caller suggests that it does in fact create the framework for a taxpayer-funded bailout for failing pension plans, as a letter from anti-tax and business groups that will be sent to congressional leaders and the White House soon. So let's look at some of the facts about the bill. The KCM Pomeroy bill, according to the two lawmakers and their staffs, are aimed at fixing a complicated problem. Many employers are withdrawing from pension funds as they face higher costs in paying for funds, where mostly union beneficiaries outnumber payees, and where the fund's performance has been lackluster. So, Democrats and some Republicans argue, business should not have to pay into a pension fund to support their own employees, plus orphan employees of firms who have left the fund. The withdrawing firms do have to pay a penalty and fees in order to exit a fund. The Casey staff used the example of the YRC Worldwide Inc., a U.S. trucking company. About 40% of YRC's pension costs are to pay the pensions of people who never worked for the company, said Casey spokesman Larry Smarr. These costs threaten the company and its 40,000 employees, he said. But to take care of these orphan employees, the Casey Pomeroy bill would create a new fund within the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation that would not be funded by premiums from businesses, which is the PBGC's normal source of revenue. Instead, all pension benefits paid by this fifth fund would be obligations of the United States, according to the bill as currently written. In addition, the PBGC is already in the red, with a deficit of $21 billion as of last fall. That shortfall is expected to increase to $34 billion by 2019, according to a report released earlier this month. So, if the already overwhelmed PBGC took on new obligations and said they were the responsibility of the government, that leaves little option other than using taxpayer funds. Smarr, Casey's spokesman, said that any cost to taxpayers would be offset under the Senate pay-as-you-go rules, but those rules have been repeatedly flouted. Smarr also said the senator's bill targets only a handful of pension plans.
So we'll keep an eye on this to see how it unfolds. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we'll continue with the second segment of the show, where we have been, over the past several months, looking at a book by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi called The Two Income Trap, Why Middle Class Parents Are Going Broke. And it has breakthrough solutions to the biggest crisis families face today. I start with the credit, because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. You could also visit the archives at www.kruufm.com. Go under Life and Debt so you can listen to and get a review of all of the shows that have been taught to help you deal with concepts regarding debt. Now, last week we were talking about some of the facts regarding the subprime mortgage crisis, the lending crisis, and its pernicious effects, and trying to show that some of the myths that permeate the media are points that we should reverse in our minds. Many people whom I speak to in the streets and even relatives, they often claim that these people who are getting their homes foreclosed on are generally at fault for what has happened to them. They should have never purchased a home without really having the resources to do it. The big banks always say that they typically had good business practices during this subprime debacle because they were helping put more people into homes. More people could own their own home. But as Professor Warren points out, this is more public relations than truth. Even when I say this point to people in a conversation, they find it hard to believe that in the overwhelming majority of cases, subprime lenders prey on families that already own their own homes rather than expanding access to new homeowners. 80% of subprime mortgages involve refinancing loans for families that already own their own homes, and that's a statistical fact. For these families, subprime lending does nothing more than increase the family's housing costs, taking resources away from other investments, and increasing the chances that the family will lose its home if anything goes wrong. And we've seen a lot has gone wrong. So first, people were not being put into homes for the first time or new homes through all of this. The vast majority were refinancing their homes. But secondly, the subprime lending industry ensnared people who, in a regulated market, would have had access to low-cost mortgages. Looking at the lenders' own data as all of these things are coming to the surface, we see that many of the families that end up in subprime contracts are middle-class families that would typically have qualified for a traditional mortgage. Professor Warren uses the example of Citibank. Researchers concluded that at least 40% of those who were sold ruinous subprime mortgages would have qualified for prime rate loans. And Citibank certainly is not an isolated case. A study by the Department of Housing and Urban Development revealed that at least 1 in 9 middle-income families and 1 in 14 upper-income families who refinanced a home mortgage ended up with a high-fee, high-interest rate subprime mortgage. For many of these families, there is no trade-off between access to credit and the cost of credit, which is the myth that has been created. In this kind of scenario, their pockets were picked, plainly and simply. But you'll ask, why would middle-class families take on high-interest mortgages if they could qualify for a better deal? The answer basically is that they didn't know they could do any better. Many unsuspecting families are steered to an overpriced mortgage by a broker or some other middle person who represents himself as acting in the borrower's best interest, but who is actually taking big fees and commissions from subprime lenders. As we talked about last week, in some neighborhoods, these brokers went door to door acting as bird dogs for lenders, looking for unsuspecting homeowners who might be tempted by the promise of extra cash.
In essence, what many people were convinced of was that the equity in their home was like a savings account, and they were tempted into using it for its cash value. And this, of course, has turned out to be a disaster for those families because the kinds of mortgages they normally had, fixed rate, long-term mortgages with low interest rates, were converted into adjustable rate mortgages with balloon payments, high interest rate, high closing fees, no lawyers helping them at the closing, often with the underlying promise that they would be able to turn this loan over again in a very short time when the initial quote-unquote good terms expired. But of course, that never happened for most of the people. Another thing that happened was that families often got broadsided by extra fees and hidden costs that
never showed up until it was too late to go to another lender, usually at the closing. The customer may have negotiated an 8% loan, but when the paperwork comes, it's 10%. I've seen this happen quite frequently. The loan officer or the broker says, "Don't worry, I'll take care of that, just sign here." But what happens is once it's signed, the "I'll take care of that" is a he said, she said argument, and frankly, it never would be supported by a court of law under usual circumstances, unless a person could prove some hardcore fraud, which is not easy. Professor Warren gave an egregious example of this, which was actually before the whole subprime disaster surfaced, but it was Citibank in 2002. They had a subprime lending subsidiary which was prosecuted for deceptive marketing practices. And the company landed up settling the case for $240 million at that time, which was the largest settlement of its kind in history. At the hearing, a loan officer, that is a former loan officer, testified how she marketed the mortgages. And, of course, this was the standard routine. If someone appeared who was uneducated, inarticulate, was a minority, or was particularly old or young, she would try to include all the additional city financial costs that were offered. In other words, lending agents routinely steered families to higher cost loans whenever they thought there was a chance to get away with it. And the steering was particularly hard against minority homeowners. Researchers have shown that minority families are more likely than white families to get stuck with subprime mortgages, even when the data were controlled for income and credit rating. One study showed that African American borrowers are 450% more likely than whites to end up with a subprime instead of a prime mortgage. Even residents in high-income, predominantly black neighborhoods are actually more likely to get a subprime mortgage than residents in low-income white neighborhoods, more than twice as likely. So what we saw is that in many cases, lenders just didn't want families' money. They wanted their house. Banks were caught deliberately issuing mortgages to families that could not afford them, with the ultimate aim at foreclosing on these homes. It became so common, the industry had its name, loan to own. Foreclosing turned out to be more profitable than simply collecting a mortgage payment every month because the property can sometimes be resold for more than the outstanding loan amount. The lender rakes in fees at closing and high monthly payments for years, waits for the family to fall behind, and sweeps in to take the property. And then the lender wins every possible way. High profit if the family manages to make all its payments, and higher profits if the family does not. And we also discuss how the servicing reality exists where the original lender doesn't even own the loan anymore and they make a lot more money when they're servicing the loan and something goes wrong. With all the mortgage deregulation, homeowners were at least 3.5 times more likely to lose their homes to foreclosure than their counterparts a generation ago. And that's in the face of low interest rates and rising home prices just before the crash. It should have all translated into a falling rate of home foreclosure, not a rising one. The lending industry had run amok, basically. The rise in loan-to-own lending, the disappearance of the down payment, the explosion of high interest, subprime refinances. All of this has taken its toll as the growing number of families learn the painful consequences of getting trapped by a mortgage industry that had been allowed to make up its own rules. And the timing could not have been worse, because just as the American corporations were starting to downsize in a major way, just when the bidding war for decent family housing was heating up in the suburbs in particularly, and just when families lost the all-purpose safety net once provided by the stay-at-home mother, easy credit flooded in, looking just like a life raft to the family that was drowning. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we have to look at the concept of where the money is. That's what banks and lenders are concerned about. That's how most businesses work. They make profits by dealing with customers who have money. And historically, that's how dealing with customers used to work for lending businesses in a very simple way. Companies made loans to people who had the money or soon would have the money to repay them. Many people point their finger at the debtor saying that they've changed their values. It used to be that people would repay their debt and go for decades to have it done. But even if we grant that, although Elizabeth Warren does not, she points out something very important. Lenders have changed too, and arguably far more than the people to whom they were lending over the last generation. Most Americans guard their credit ratings jealously, living with the slightly prickly sensation that they could be cut off if they fell behind or forgot to pay a bill. What they don't realize is that when a borrower makes a partial payment, when he misses a bill, or when his credit rating drops for whatever reason, he actually gets more offers for credit. A person's not just down on their luck, behind on their bills, or short on cash, but they've joined the ranks of an elite group, the lending industry's most profitable customers. Professor Warren gives an example set by Citibank, which at the time was America's largest credit card issuer. This was in 1990. She was hired to be a one-day consultant by Citibank to address a gathering of some 40 senior lending executives. The task was to use her research to suggest policies that would help Citibank cut its losses from cardholders in financial trouble. She arrived at Citibank's New York headquarters with dozens of graphs and charts tucked in her file folders. She was ushered into a large, brightly lit conference room where each chair was filled by someone fitted in a starched shirt, silk tie, and dark suit. The executives stayed with her all day, eating lunch at the conference tables, as they continued their discussion about the effects of unemployment on loan defaults and the rising number of bankruptcies among two-earner families. She says that as the afternoon came to a close, she summarized her recommendations. The short version could be boiled down to a single, not very startling idea. Stop lending money to families that are already in obvious financial trouble. This would have been quite easy to implement. Citibank had reams of data on most of its borrowers, particularly those who had a black mark on their credit reports. Professor Warren suggested that the policy could be put into place within a few short months, potentially cutting Citibank's bankruptcy-related losses by as much as 50%. She said that there were interested murmurs around the room and several hands eagerly shot up. But before she could call on anyone, one slightly older man spoke up. He had been silent throughout the long day, leaning back in his chair and giving her a faintly bemused smile. "Professor Warren," he began. The room hushed immediately, and I suddenly realized that I had been oblivious to the corporate pecking order. This was the guy who outranked everyone else in the room. And he said, "We appreciate your presentation. We really do. But we have no interest in cutting back on our lending to these people. They are the ones who provide most of our profits." With that, he got up and the meeting was over. She was ushered out of the room and she never heard from Citibank again, except to get her monthly credit card bills. Citibank understood the new economics of consumer credit. Credit card issuers make their profits from lending lots of money and charging hefty fees to families that are financially strapped. More than 75% of credit card profits come from people who make those low minimum monthly payments. And who makes minimum monthly payments at 26%, 29% and higher interest? Who pays late fees, overbalance charges, and cash advance premiums? Obviously, it's families that can barely make ends meet. Households precariously balanced between financial survival and complete collapse. These are the families that are singled out by the lending industry, barraged with special offers, personalized advertisements, and home phone calls, all with one objective in mind: get them to borrow more money. Professor Warren gives a story. After a man suffered a heart attack, missed several months of work, and fell behind on his mortgage, Jamal got the hard sell from his mortgage lender. When Jamal missed a payment, the mortgage company sent him dozens of personalized letters with a single goal: to persuade him to take out yet another mortgage. He was receiving notices that said, "You need a vacation. Take out this $1,000 and pay it back in 90 days. Now, if he didn't pay it back in 90 days, they charged him 22% interest. When he didn't respond to the mailers, the mortgage company started calling Jamal at home, and often as many as 4 times a week. Again, the company wasn't calling initially to collect payments he had already missed. It was calling to sign him up for even more debt. Jamal resisted, but his mortgage lender didn't let up. When he turned them down, they called his wife, trying to get her to talk with Jamal. So this was the new lending strategy, which was exactly the reverse of the approach used by bankers a generation ago, when their main goal was to be repaid on time, not to string along the payments for as long as possible, which is now the new goal. The lending policies back then were radically different from those embraced by today's major lenders. Unlike today's mega banks, in the old days, the lender stopped making loans when a family got in trouble. Nor would a bank have suggested a second mortgage to the family that had just missed a payment on its first mortgage. So that's an important difference between a generation ago and since the bank deregulation took effect. And of course, there was another important difference. Back then, when families arranged credit, the lender charged a simple 1% per month interest. The banks did not have any penalty fees or shifting rates of interest. When someone missed a payment, the rate was still 1% a month, or some such number. Today, that practice has totally disappeared. Like Jamal's mortgage lender, many banks routinely double or even triple the interest rate the moment someone is a few days late with the payment. Then there are the fees. In the year 2002, the credit card companies charged more than $7 billion in late fees, 4 times what they charged in 1990. Now, this was a penalty unheard of in our grandfather's days. And another thing was that when the lender back then got the check, they applied it to the principal balance on the loan. They never would have dreamed of telling those families that with compounded interest at the new rates and special overbalance fees and late payment penalties, they now owe $4,000 on their original $800 purchase. So times had changed dramatically, and from a financial point of view, fatally for many families. And now in this era when lenders routinely targeted the almost bankrupt for extra loans, how did they ensure that they would get their money back? Again, this is assuming that they're even keeping the loans. Corporate lenders don't have the Jimmy the finger breaker on retainer, but they do have thousands of trained professionals who do nothing but hound families for money. Most of the time, these agents make their living by calling families at home, reminding them that they are late on their bills, and pressing them to make a payment. And when simple requests aren't enough, they too use tougher tactics, and we will continue with this discussion next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from True LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.